Afternoon and welcome to House Labor and Commerce. It is 3:17 p.m. on Monday, April 9th. Members present are Representative Birch, Representative Josephson, Vice Chair Wool, myself, Chair Keto. We do have a quorum to conduct business. Representative Knopp is excused. Support staff today are Susie Edwardson as our recording secretary, Ben Manley as our LIO moderator. Today we've got four items on the agenda. We are going to be reviewing and forwarding the governor's boards and commissions appointees, hearing House Bill 193, healthcare balance billing, House Bill 358, insurance coverage for telehealth, and House Bill 376, create the Alaska State Bank. First item, and I'd like to have the record show that Representative Sullivan Leonard joined us at 3:18 p.m. First item of business is consideration of the governor's appointments to boards and commissions. Our role here is to forward those names to the joint session, which will be taking place tomorrow. We received 56 names on February 2nd. We received two additional names on March 13th. And then received two additional names beyond that on March 29th. Three of the individuals that were submitted to the committee have withdrawn their names from consideration, and we've asked members to submit names of appointees they would like to speak with directly. We brought nine individuals before committee, and we have forwarded the DCCED commissioner designee, Mr. Navarre, to the joint session, and today we will be considering the 56 names that will be considered as boards and commissions members for joint session tomorrow. And so in interests of making the record complete, I will be reading the appointee names and the boards in which they are proposed for. So first is the Board of the Alaska State Board of Public Accountancy. We have Leslie Schmitz from Anchorage and Karen Smith from Anchorage. The Alcoholic Beverage Control Board, Sarah Kaprushitz from Soldotna and Glenn Brady from Fairbanks. Architects, Engineers, and Land Surveyors, State Board of Registration. William Mott, Anchorage. Luann Erfer, Eagle River. Jennifer Anderson, Anchorage. Richard Jones, Juneau. Board of Barbers and Hairdressers, Vershawn Idem, Anchorage. Board of Chiropractic Examiners, James Morris, Dutch Harbor. Board of Dental Examiners, Dominic Wenzel, Girdwood, Robin Watto, Anchorage. The Alaska Labor Relations Agency, Tyler Andrews, Anchorage. Melinda Cosgrove, Juneau. Lon Needles, Valdez. Marijuana Control Board, Lauren Jones, Douglas, Nicholas Miller, Anchorage. Board of Marine Pilots, Peggy Laughlin, Dutch Harbor, Richard Harris, Juneau, Les Kronk, Ketchikan. Board of Marital and Family Therapy, Natalie Lewis, Kotzebue. Board of Massage Therapists, David Edward Smith, Soldotna, and Jill Motz, Wasilla. Board of Certified Direct Entry Midwives, Kenny Linden of Palmer, Diana Christeller, Fairbanks.
Object to the applicant of Kenny Linden.
We will make a separate motion for that. We'll have to take an at ease to do that motion. Okay. Board of Nursing, Starla Fox, Dillingham. Linda Hutchins, Soldotna. Board of Examiners and Optometry, Damian Deltzer, Fairbanks, Eric Lingle, Juneau. Board of Pharmacy, Tammy Lindemuth, Anchorage, Sharon Long, Anchorage, Lana Bell, Anchorage. Board of Physical and Occupational Therapy, Keith Porbaugh, Palmer, Robert Calhoun, Anchorage. Professional Counselors, Steve Cardwell, Fairbanks. Janice Richard, Anchorage. Alice Baum, Anchorage. Board of Psychologists and Psychological Associate Examiners, Paul Durkham, Fairbanks. Real Estate Appraisers, Board of Certified Real Estate Appraisers, Don Falconberry, Anchorage, David Derry, Kenai, Wendy Lawrence, Sitka. Regulatory Commission of Alaska, Janice Wilson, Anchorage, Paul Lozanski, Anchorage, Anthony Scott, Anchorage. Board of Social Work Examiners, Lisa Hay, Fairbanks, Danielle LaFon, Fairbanks. Board of Veterinary Examiners, Chris Machete, Anchorage. Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission, Mike Notar, Juneau. And Workers' Compensation Board, Bradley Evans, Anchorage, David Kester, Anchorage, Justin Mack, Anchorage, Nancy Shaw, Anchorage, Jacob Housdell, North Pole, Bronson Fry, Anchorage, Robert Wheel, Anchorage, Pamela Klein, Wasilla. I will finish this after we take a brief at ease. Back on the record at 3:30 p.m., and we have new motions for the committee. We have prepared a motion that includes all names except for the one that has received an objection. Is there any objection to moving that forward? And as a reminder, the signing this form moving the appointees to the joint session does not reflect an intent by any member to vote for or against any of the individuals during any joint session, or I guess it would be the joint session. So I guess, is there objection to moving all of the members with the exception of Kenny Linden from Palmer to the joint session of the legislature? Seeing no objection, we will take an at ease and pass the form around for signature. Back on the record in House Labor and Commerce at 3:33 p.m., we have a separate motion for Midwives Board of Certified Direct Entry, Kenny Linden, and there was an objection. And again, signature of this sheet does not reflect an intent by any of the members to vote for or against this individual during the joint session of the legislature for the purposes of approval. We have an objection. I've stated that. Can we have a roll call vote, please, on Ms. Kenny Linden of Palmer?
No, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Chairman, can I speak to my objection?
Yes, you may.
Okay. Mr. Chairman and committee members, I've received hundreds of emails and phone calls from constituents in the Mat-Su Valley who have voiced their objection to this member being included in the midwifery board. I think that's very significant. And in looking at the composition of the midwifery board itself, we do have representation from the Mat-Su Valley, and I think that's an important component to look at when you look at each board. The member from Mat-Su on there is a midwife. The position that Ms. Linden has applied for is a public seat. Mr. Chairman, I'm pretty careful about the boards and commissions and really want to make sure there's a good fit for people that apply, but more importantly, when I get such an outpouring of concern from constituents, I need to act on that, and that's my objection.
Okay, and vote.
So my objection was yes to the objection.
Oh, sorry. So void the vote. We'll start over again.
Are we taking comments then?
No, she was going to speak to her objection.
Oh, okay.
We had Ms. Linden before the committee before. There were opportunities to comment and discuss her at that time. Okay. Let's start over, please.
Representative Sullivan Leonard?
Yes.
Representative Stutes?
No, I'm saying yes to the objection.
No, you're voting on whether she's
no.
Void the vote.
We'll
take a brief at ease. Thank you, and roll call again.
Representative Knopf?
Absent.
No.
Representative Stutes?
Yes.
Representative Josephson?
Yes.
Representative Wolf?
Yes.
Representative Birch?
No.
Chair Kito?
Yes.
Four yeas, two nays.
With a vote of four yeas and two nays, Ms. Linden's name has been forwarded to the joint session. We'll take a brief at ease. We are back on the record at 3:39 p.m. in House Labor and Commerce. Next item before the committee is House Bill 193, Healthcare Balance Billing. Representative Gren and Mr. Johnson.
Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Ryan Johnston, staff to Representative Gren. Unfortunately, he's up in House Finance right now, and he apologizes for not being able to be here. If the committee chair would like, I'm ready to run through the sectional of the bill for the committee.
Mr. Johnston, yes, thank you. Actually, if you could do a brief introduction of what the intent of the bill is, and then go ahead and move right into your sectional analysis.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's usually the representative's job. Briefly, House Bill 193 is a ban on balance billing and also enacts a hold harmless for insurance providers, essentially to remove consumers in emergency situations from the hectic and somewhat cumbersome billing process that occurs. So the bill is really a Consumer Protection Act looking to protect Alaskans in emergency situations. So I'll run through the sectional now. Section 1 establishes a hold harmless standard for insurance providers in the situation where a covered person receives medical care from an out-of-network medical provider in an emergency situation. An insurance provider will hold a covered person harmless to ensure that a covered person will only pay what would have been paid if the medical provider was an in-network provider. The Section 1 outlines the standards to establish the situations where a medical provider cannot balance bill a covered person. An insurance provider shall pay a non-network health care provider if the health care provider renders to a covered person emergency services or treats an emergency medical condition, services that are received in an in-network facility by an out-of-network provider, services for which a referral was made by an in-network health care provider to an out-of-network health care provider without the explicit written consent of the covered person. The covered person is required to pay only the in-network rates for the deductible, coinsurance, and copayment. The amount paid by the covered person is required to be counted towards the covered person's in-network deductible, and the final payment determined for the medical provider will subtract any amount paid by the covered person. The insurance provider is to pay the greater of three possible amounts. The median negotiated contracted rate generated using the in-network healthcare in providers for that insurance provider that is equal to the 80th percentile of charges for the services calculated using a method that establishes a statistically credible profile that reflects the general cost differences between the geographical area where the service was performed and other geographical areas. And then the last would be the amount that would be paid under Medicare at 350%. Medical providers are required to send bills to the insurance provider except for the in-network deductible, coinsurance, and copayment amounts determined by the insurance provider, and contains a clause that if a covered person knowingly elects to use an out-of-network medical provider, they then can be balance billed for those services. Section 2, healthcare insurance plans obtained by the state under AS 3930090 or provided under AS 3930091 will be subject to only the requirements of Section 2136.512 and 2136.513, which are the new sections implemented by the bill. Section 3 bans the practice of balance billing by a medical provider under the criteria of Section 1, stipulates that a medical provider can still bill for the patient's deductible, coinsurance, and copayment, which will be set at an in-network level by the insurance provider, and states that a medical provider will be paid in accordance to Section 1 of the bill. Section 4 establishes that punishment for medical providers under the unfair trade practices and consumer protection. And that concludes the sectional in my prepared testimony, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you. We have any questions for Mr. Johnston? Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Have you had an opportunity to review the letter received in testimony from the America's Health Insurance Plans resulting, basically addressing some of the concerns with 193?
I was wondering
if maybe you could speak to them. Basically, it's kind of an equity issue for, you know, small businesses and
the
chairman. Yeah.
Through the chair, Representative Birch, that's why we put in Section 2. Philosophically, Representative Gren believes that you're absolutely correct. If we were going to require private insurers to do this, then the state plans under 3930, 090, and 091 should be held to the same standards. So in response to your question, we have addressed that by doing what we could. Because of ERISA, labor plans and self-funded plans, those large self-funded plans, we can't regulate those at the state level. But philosophically, we could address 090 and 091. And so in our eyes, we made it as equitable as we possibly could in relation to that letter, sir.
Follow-up? Through the chairman, in reviewing the fiscal note, obviously it's there's going to be some costs involved, but this doesn't have anything in it. I mean, it's non-conclusive. I was wondering if you could speak to the cost component through the chair.
Through the chair, Representative Birch, in our eyes, it's a cost savings for the state because currently retirement and benefits pays the 100% billed amount in an emergency situation. The state does hold state employees harmless. We just thought the state shouldn't be paying the full billed amount if private insurers will not be paying the full amount either. So we see it as a cost savings. We've been working with the department trying to figure out all the little nuances that we need to get right in the bill. But in our eyes, we see it as a cost savings for the state. And they in the fiscal note, they also bring up the concern about the greater of where Alaska rates would be applied to other states. But in the bill, the 80th percentile stipulation in the billing section actually states that it has to be where the services were rendered. So if a state employee was in Oregon, let's say, was injured and had to go to the emergency room, the state would then just use Oregon's 80th percentile. We wouldn't use Alaska's 80th percentile for that service. So, but if we need to clean up that language even more to make that explicitly clear, because that's just common sense, we wouldn't use Alaska insurance rates for Oregon or Washington. So if we just need to clean that up, that's more than willing to
great.
Talk
thank
about
you.
That.
Thank you,
thank
sure.
you. Any other questions for Mr. Johnson? Not. Thank you for your introduction of the bill. And we do have next up Dr. Ann Zink with the Metsu Emergency Room, I guess. I'll let her explain her affiliation. So, Dr. Zink, if you come forward, place your name and affiliation on the record and provide us with your presentation, please.
Thank you, Chairman. My name is Ann Zink, Z-I-N-K. I'm a practicing emergency physician at Mattsu Regional Emergency Department, and I'm here representing really the emergency medicine physicians of the state. There's a thing called the American College of Emergency Medicine Physicians, and we have a state chapter that represents about 80% of the physicians in the state, and our board has a makeup of people from all across the state. So we try to look at what's happening in rural areas as well as urban areas. And we appreciate the time to just go through a little bit of invited testimony about our perspective of this bill as it really affects emergency providers. So whenever we come here to testify, we ask ourselves just one question, and what is right for the patient? That's why we got into healthcare, and that's why we're here today. And this bill is titled An Act Relating to Emergency Services and a Ban on Balanced Billing, but I think it really has a better name, and that is really to end the surprise insurance gap. And so I'm going to kind of walk through what that is and what this means from a patient perspective. So again, I'm a physician, and so when I think about any problem, I think about it from a patient's perspective. I think about what happens to them and what this means for them at the end of the day. So you get in a car accident out at Mattsu, you're taken into the emergency department, and you are cared for there. You're seen by an emergency medicine physician. You probably have some imaging done. You might be seen by a surgeon, and maybe you need a service that isn't rendered at that hospital. So you either get driven by EMS or you get flown to Anchorage where you get additional care. So I'm going to kind of walk through what that looks like from the patient's perspective. So there's this whole team that's sitting there. It may be EMS, it may be helicopter, it may be services at different hospitals. And as we all know, the state is large, and there is a lot of geographic challenges to making this safety net work for a patient anywhere, any time of day, anywhere in Alaska. So you have this crisis and you're taken care of and you're discharged from the hospital and you're thankful that you did okay. And then you start to get bills and you're trying to figure out what that really means. And this is becoming an increasing problem from people around the state. So maybe you get an EMS bill. Maybe you get a physician bill from the first ER physician you saw in that first hospital that you were at, the radiologist who read your initial images. And then, as I mentioned, you were maybe transferred because we really only have neurosurgery in Anchorage. We only have some specialty care in Anchorage, and sometimes we have to send people to Seattle as well for care. So you get a bill from hospital number two, that second emergency physician who saw you, another surgeon who took care of you, the anesthesiologist who took care of that care, the second radiologist who reread your images, the hospitalist who helped coordinate your care, some medication, laboratory work. I tried to choose a fairly basic. It can get much more complicated than this very quickly, but I only could fit so much on the slide at once. And it's interesting to think about what's happening across the country. So 44% of people who reported they did not seek treatment when they were injured or sick because of the cost of care, and we're really seeing that go up. And 35% of Americans would have trouble paying their regular bills if they were faced with just a $400 health emergency bill. And medical bills are thought to be the number one reason for bankruptcy in this country. And so this makes a big difference. Not only is health insurance really expensive, but if you have a medical emergency that's going to cause bankruptcy, that's a big deal. And people say, well, I have health insurance. Like, I should be covered in this emergency. And you would think that that was true. So I just copied here my partner's bronze plan. This is very similar to my bronze plan that we have today. So for my family of four, healthy, pay $21,000 a year, $17,000 a month, just over that. And I just screenshotted what that looks like because this bill applies to how health insurance has kind of broken up healthcare into different components. So you're going to notice three different parts that I'm going to talk about here. There's this component of in-network and out-of-network. There's a deductible, and you'll notice that the in-network deductible is $10,500 versus the out-of-network deductible is $21,000. And then this is the arrow that scares me personally the most. Every day I drive down the road with my kids, there's no maximum out-of-pocket that I could be responsible for if I have an out-of-network expense. So there is no limit to what that means. So let's go through that case. So take all of those bills. Let's say it's $100,000. I'm going to make the math easy. So that's a lot of money. And of that, I have this deductible. I have a $10,000 deductible, and the insurance plan pays the rest. So that's kind of what I'm expecting. Insurance pays the majority of that bill, and I call this insurance gap number one, but this is a known insurance gap. I know that I have a deductible, and that's what I'd have to pay for. So that's that $10,500 with a $13,000 max. But what really happens is that sometimes people are out of network. So maybe EMS, hospital one, the emergency physician number one are in network, but the radiologist isn't in network, or maybe that surgeon isn't in network, or the anesthesiologist. And you as a patient have no way to know this, particularly in an emergency. You're going to just be taken wherever you need to go. And you're going to start to get these bills, and you don't realize that a portion of these bills are going to apply to this out-of-network deductible that you had no idea was a part of what was going on. So this is another way to summarize it. You think that your insurance covers what you get for care in the hospital. When you go to an in-network hospital, you expect everything in that hospital to be covered as in-network. But what's really happening is insurance companies are narrowing their network significantly, leaving many doctors out of network who are actively caring at that hospital. And so then when you go to be cared for choice or not for choice, in your emergency situation, you don't get to choose who your anesthesiologist is. You're not choosing who your surgeon is. It's whoever's on call that day. They may be out of network, and you don't have any choice over that. I think it's important to remember that physicians want to be in network. It's much easier for us. It's much simpler. We want to care for patients. That's why we got into healthcare in the first place. Oftentimes, insurance companies will not allow us to be in network. So if you've got a patient who's from the lower 48 who's visiting, or maybe they work for a large company that doesn't offer insurance, we can't always be in network. And sometimes their rates are so low that we can't, it's not a feasible rate to actually be able to keep the doors open. There's a huge monopoly, and so sometimes there's just no negotiation power. We're individual physicians working at small hospitals, trying to do our best at working with large companies. And a study in 2015 found that 50% of Alaskan marketplace offers narrow networks, leaving patients with few in-network choices and exposing them to these surprise bills. So now let's go
to that slide.
Yep.
Do you have a question? Sorry. I just wanted to look at this. Thank you.
Yeah, no problem. So let's go back to our case, and this is more what sometimes does happen, can happen, and is happening really extensively throughout the lower 48. So now we got our $100,000, but let's say 50% of that is out-of-network. So now I've got a $50,000 out-of-network component, and my deductible went from $10,500 to $21,000. It's a much bigger percentage, and my insurance company then is only going to pay $29,000 of that total. So now I've got my balance bill, I've got an increased deductible, and my insurance company only plays a small part of the bill. And so this component is this insurance gap number two, or a surprise insurance gap. So now I'm stuck with $71,000 with no max. That's devastating for a family. They can't afford that, and trying to figure out what that looks like is hard to plan for. So what does this bill do? A ban on balance billing really kind of ends that surprise insurance gap. So here we have our same breakdown. We've got our same balance bill and our insurance gap number two. So if we ban balance billing and get rid of that surprise insurance gap, it takes out that portion of it. It says that physicians, hospitals cannot bill for that second portion of it. It only allows you to bill for that initial copay and deduction component of it. You're still stuck with a larger deductible, but 50% of that cost cannot be billed for. It protects the patient because they don't get that surprise bill. Now, to change things around a little bit, now I'm going to talk about what that's like from a provider's perspective, because now I've just cut off half of the bill that it costs to care for that patient. So as an emergency provider, I think of this as a three-legged stool. I've got really three options to stay in business and be able to care for patients. I can limit who I can see. I can have fair in-network reimbursement. I can bill the patient. That's all I can really do. What we see is that when you limit, many clinics limit who they can see. So they're not going to see Medicare or Medicaid, and we've heard a lot about the difficulty of seeing Medicare and Medicaid patients because that doesn't reimburse very well, and so it's hard to get primary care. There is a federal law called EMTALA. It was passed in 1986, and basically it requires every hospital to have an emergency department that sees everyone regardless of their ability to pay. So functionally, as emergency providers and anyone on an EMTALA call, that limits completely who I see for patients. So that limits that first one. I chose emergency medicine because I value that ethical, but it really changes kind of the balance of what you do. So now one of my stools is taken out, one of my legs on my stool. And then if I limit balance billing, I'm basically taking away the other leg on that stool. And so you can see that the entire safety net is then reliant on one peg. And that's fair network reimbursement. And that's why that is so critical to this bill. If you're going to take away one of those leverage points, the billing component, you have to have some really robust fair in-network billing. And to do that, you really have to have two things. You have to preserve the safety net. It must be geographically relevant, and it must be based on a not-for-profit, independent, transparent database not controlled by any industry. That's including physicians, insurance companies, and what we've seen in the lower 48 is, like in New York State, insurance companies made their own database, and the Attorney General of New York sued them over this and said, you can't just make up your own data. So having true transparent data that we can all see is really important to making this survive. So that comes back to this bill, and this talks about the 80th percentile. So Ryan mentioned that earlier. There's a lot of myth and reality about the 80th percentile, and I'm going to talk through a few things why I think this is important. There's a lot of noise about the 80th percentile right now, and also through the media as well as in many conversations, and I think it's important to look at some of the data. I feel like I'm a scientist first and foremost, and I want to see the data, and I want to see the science. So ELASA is expensive for healthcare. It's not the most expensive in the country, as been told. So here you can see the District of Columbia is the most expensive, Alaska, Massachusetts, and Delaware, if you're looking at healthcare capita spending.
Question from Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry to interrupt. You're going at a pretty good clip, so I figured I'd better just grab you. That's a column that says health spending, but that's not really health costs. That's just how much people spend. That doesn't say how much a procedure here costs compared to a procedure in Massachusetts or Delaware, et cetera, correct?
Yeah, through the chair, you're correct, Representative, and I'll talk a little bit about emergency costs coming up because that is different. This is overall health spending.
Okay, continue.
And you can see that there's not a lot of variation as well here, so you would think that there could be potentially more variation. Rural states in general pay more for physicians. So here you can see what physicians' take-home salary is across the country, and we, again, are the second highest here. But you can see rural states are hard places to recruit physicians. And again, we're expensive, but we're not the most expensive. Now, the 80th percentile really just affects the public market, the private healthcare insurance market. And so this is a graph that you can pull up from Kaiser Family Foundation. And there's an 80th percentile regulation that is in existence today that went into place in 2004. And you can see the yellow bottom line is healthcare as a private healthcare insurance spending per capita. And the yellow is the United States, and the orange is Alaska. And you can see that when Alaska put into place the 80th percentile regulation, that basically required insurance companies to pay the 80th percentile for the geographically relevant out-of-network billing, they didn't see any change in the curves. There's a lot of discussion right now in the media that this is really causing the high cost of healthcare in Alaska, but you can see that there's no real data that we have to support that. So here is that private healthcare spending curve. There's also been talk that Alaska is the only state that has this, and I apologize, there's a little bit of, it didn't come out quite right. But New York and Connecticut are two other states that have an 80th percentile. And those were both passed in 2014. And many other states are considering or have similar patient protection measures in place right now. So Alaska is not the only place that has this 80th percentile marking as a way to ensure insurance companies pay a fair out-of-network minimum. And you can see in the states that have had it for a little bit longer, so Connecticut and New York, you can see no increase in charges after the 80th percentile rule was put into place. So this is a little bit of a complicated slide if you don't understand healthcare billing. So this is a series of billed charges in the emergency department. The important thing to look at is that orange line is the old ones and the blue line is the new ones. So orange was before 2014 when the 80th percentile just went into place. And the blue is the most recent in May in 2017. So you can see every code, the charges are about the same. So there's been a belief that the 80th percentile causes increased charges, and we don't see that in Connecticut or New York, where we've got more robust data. I think it's also important to understand that in 2017, the National Insurance Commissioners made model legislation regarding out-of-network balance billing, and in it they stated that it's based that for usual and customary costs, they shall use the 80th percentile of the same geographic region based on a not-for-profit organization. So the National Insurance Commissioners, a bipartisan group from around the country looking at patient protection, really used very similar language to this bill. And so people have thought about this for a long time, and a lot of different permutations of it use a very similar way to calculate what should be paid. So this gets back to Representative Wohl, your question regarding what are the costs and what do those really look like. So this is from Fair Health, and you can see that these are two different codes. This is like the most critical code when a patient comes into the emergency department. So a bad trauma, bad heart attack gets billed as a 99285. So for Anchorage, the out-of-network cost for that is $1,057 versus in-network is $404. And for Seattle, you can see the cost is slightly higher at $1,177 versus in-network is $455. So there's very similar pricing for emergency costs. And if you look at it across the nation, this is emergency department visits as looking at that highest code. The ones in the light blue, this is a percentage of Medicare. You can see that the billed charges in those light blue states are the lowest that happen in the country. So you can see down the south, that's where you're going to see the highest. So if you look at the billed charges for emergency care in Alaska, it's actually quite a bit lower than other billed charges across the country. So it's important to kind of, this is a bill applying to emergency care, so we pulled emergency care data. So 80th percentile is a patient protection issue. It's really not about how much doctors make. It's much more of a question of who pays the bill. A patient who already hasn't paid for insurance or the insurance company. So it's about shifting costs, not about saving costs. And I think it's important to understand that difference. The second component of any sort of fair network is going to be the fact that it needs to be based on a not-for-profit, independent, transparent database not controlled by any industry. I think we all deserve transparent data so that we can make good decisions about healthcare. CMS looked around and said, what makes sense to base to use as an organization? And they found that Fair Health was the most fair way to do it. Some states have their own all-claims databases. We don't have an all-claims database in Alaska. But I think whatever we decide to do, we need to make sure it's based on some not-for-profit transparent database. So as I've been said before, healthcare is complicated. And the goal of healthcare is really to provide is for healthy population at a cost that we can afford. And to do that, I would emphasize that we need to make sure that we do three things. We make sure it's geographically relevant, it's based on transparent, objective data, and it puts the patient's health care first. And therefore, we believe that HB 193 is a compromise, getting rid of balance billing, but that will protect patients. It ends these surprise bills, it protects patients from high costs, and it maintains access to care. After all, what is health insurance if it fails? This is an emergency, and so we ask your support in House Bill 193.
Thank you, Dr. Zink. Mm-hmm. And I've got a question, kind of a follow-up perhaps on what Representative Burchett started asking earlier, and that was the America's Health Insurance Association or group. It indicated that it would be harder to bring physicians into network if something like this were to pass. Do you have any thoughts or comments on the relative ease or difficulty in providers joining a specific network?
Yeah, Representative, I don't have concerns about that. The reason that the 80th percentile regulation went into place was to try to get patients in providers in network rather than patients getting these large unexpected bills. And so if there's a relatively good out of network minimum, it encourages providers to be in network. The other thing that encourages providers to be in-network is just general competition. So as we've seen the state have more competition with more providers, we've seen more and more people go in-network as well.
Okay, thanks, and I think we needed to have that on the record. We've got a question from Representative Birch.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your service, and thank you for your presentation today. One of the questions I keep coming up with, and we don't dabble in the health and social services world much, or I don't, or haven't, other than we kind of intersect here in labor and commerce once in a while. But where do the hospitals fit in to this picture through the chair? And I, you know, there's all sorts of discussion about hospitals writing off charges. Is that primarily relate to when the physicians work for the hospital, or it's more of a general question than maybe this is able to address. But your thoughts on, does the hospital have a seat at the table? Because I mean, we're talking physicians and insurance companies and patients, but I don't see the hospital mentioned up here.
Yeah, so Representative Birch, through the chair, it's a great question. Again, as a patient, you just care about your overall bill when you care about what happens. So the hospital bill is a component of that. The exact details of how hospitals bill and don't bill is always a little bit of a mystery to me as a physician. and so I'd have to let Astra weigh in specifically on that. But my understanding of this bill is that it would include all of those bills. And so they could not bill above, if they were not in network, then they couldn't have bill, you couldn't get a surprise bill above the 80th percentile as well.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Bull.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess what I gleaned from your presentation is as much of more of a problem as between in-network and out-of-network, and not necessarily the bill, that if you go into a hospital and you see 12 people and six of them are in-network and six are out, and you don't even know until mm-hmm. you get your bill. So I guess this bill, when I say bill, I mean the House bill,
yeah.
it obviously isn't addressing that at all, and that's more of a structural problem that and you made some reference to it. There's two parts of the during your presentation. One was a balance billing or eliminating balance billing, and the other one was a database, and that's not addressed in the bill. And can you say that what that is again?
Yeah, no problem. Thank you, Representative Wolf, through the chair. So we talked about the fact that you have to have good in-network and out-of-networks. You've got to have some sort of good structure for the insurance companies to reimburse based on. And therefore, you have to have it geographically relevant and based on a not-for-profit transparent database. The way that this bill is currently structured, that's really up to the insurance commissioner on the way that that's done. We already have regulation that would somewhat protect that. It doesn't clearly state out one specific way that that's done, but we feel as though the way that it is set up currently in the bill meets that need, meets the need of being geographically relevant as well as being based on a non-insurance-driven or non-provider-driven database.
Okay. Follow up.
Does that answer your question? No?
Sure. well, the other part is that this covers emergency treatment. So if you go into the ER from a car wreck or what have you. The example you gave was someone comes in, they're medevac to another facility. At what point does it become emergency, and at what point does it become, you know, I think of emergency as we got to do this now, but then you get transferred to another facility, and then you're a day or two later, and they say, well, you have this problem, we could do this surgery, or we could wait, or we could do this or that, and then you have time. And again, you're still at that network, in and out of network situation where you don't know the next person coming in your room if they're, you know, what's their letter? Are they in network or out of network? So it goes beyond emergency. I mean, is there a delineation? You know, if you're flown out elsewhere for you need a bone graft or something. I mean, that's non-emergency, but it's critical, I guess. I don't know. Do you delineate between those two things?
Yeah, Representative Wolf, the chair, it's a question that we talk about every single day on every single shift, is trying to decide what's emergent, what's not emergent. So EMTALA defines emergency as the layperson's understanding of what is an emergency when they first come into the emergency department. So anyone can come to an emergency department for what they feel is an emergency, and we have to do a medical screening exam and stabilization. If we screen them and say this is an emergent, you're okay, you can go home, then additional services can't be used underneath that same component. So when someone's on EMTALA call or under this call, like for a surgeon for a gallbladder, if we feel as though their immediate life or limb is not threatened without immediate intervention, I can't force that surgeon to come in and take care of them. I can say, you have gallbladder disease. I'm going to need you to follow up. You're probably going to need this out, but it isn't emergent. So we're always having that conversation. There have been numerous court cases that help delineate this, and I think it would be very similarly applied. We've been practicing delineating this federal law since 1986, and the way that this is written basically follows the federal law.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Zink. Any other questions? Well, thank you for your presentation.
Thank you.
And I will say I was at a national conference this past year, and there was an insurance professional that was in a situation where they were in a hospital for a procedure, and this insurance professional made a point as she was on the table to ask the anesthesiologist if he was in network or out of network before she agreed to allow him to anesthetize her. So that situation kind of pointed out the challenges with being a layperson that doesn't know to be able to ask those questions and request an in-network provider, because you're there receiving care and you're there at an institution. We as lay people have no idea that there's a mixture of billing and affiliations that are associated with hospitals and medical providers.
Yeah, I think it brings up a really great point. And you don't also know, there may be no one else on call who can take care of that service as well. So the only person who may be on call for surgery or anesthesia may be an out-of-network provider, but it's the only person who is available to provide that service, particularly in the state.
Thank you. Representative Will has a follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So along that line, if I go to a hospital and let's say I need an emergency appendectomy, an anesthesiologist, which who I have no control over, I already said because it's emergency, I would be covered under this bill. But I guess there's a situation where in the same facility, one anesthesiologist is in network and the other one's out of network, and I have no way of knowing, probably till I get my bill, unless I ask them before they knock me out. Is that correct?
Yes, so Representative Wolf, the chair, that would be correct, and that's why it's really important in an emergency when you have no control over that you are protected in that situation, and that we can be able to provide you the care that you need. Unfortunately, we are seeing this question come up more and more with patients who come into the emergency department, and they say, I don't want you to perform an appendectomy because my insurance is with Alaska Regional, and so I'm worried getting stuck with the bill, but I can't transfer the person to Alaska Regional because I have that service at my hospital. So EMTALA mandates that if you have that service at your hospital, you can't transfer to another hospital, and that's a patient request, and so then they might be stuck with the EMS bill. So it becomes very sticky, very quickly, particularly in a state like this where we just don't have a lot of providers and we have a lot of distance between places.
Thank you. Any other follow-up or questions? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. We also have Emily Ritchie with the Healthcare Policy Administrator with the state, and Anna Latham, Deputy Director of the Division of Insurance, available for questions. Does anybody have any questions for departments? Seeing none, at this time we will open up public testimony for 11 p.m. and check my register, and I do not see anyone signed up for public testimony, so we will leave public testimony open and set House Bill 193 aside and then move on to House Bill 358. Thank you. House Bill 358, Representative Sponholz, if you can come forward with your staff, Ms. Nesbitt, and provide us with your name and affiliation.
Good afternoon. I'm Representative Ivy Sponholz, representing District 16 in East Anchorage, and with me is my aide, Bernice Nesbitt. Today we're presenting House Bill 358, which is insurance coverage for telehealth. So at its core, really, HB 358 is about increasing access to health care in the state of Alaska while reducing costs by requiring that insurance coverage in the private market cover telehealth delivered care. It'll essentially reduce the cost of care by reducing the amount of travel that Alaskans need to undertake in order to make sure that they access appropriate level care, and it will increase access as well in a similar sort of way. There are many communities in rural Alaska where you cannot access either a behavioral health provider or a specialist of some kind, and so being able to get more of your health care delivered via telehealth will solve that problem. Telehealth is already covered and provided by Medicaid and in the Indian Health Service. It's really effective in those markets, and so we want to be able to expand that access to the private market. All right, and Bernice Nesbitt will go ahead and do a sectional analysis, if that's all right.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Nesbitt, for the record.
For the record, Bernice Nesbitt, staff to Representative Ivy Sponholz. In front of you should be HB 358, and we're looking at 30-LS1216-J. So Section 1 is where a health care insurer that's mandated by the Division of Insurance is going to pay for benefits for any of their covered services delivered via telehealth. So if you are a provider in the state of Alaska and you have a license under the Alaska State Medical Board and you provide a covered service via telehealth, you'll be reimbursed for those services. And an initial in-person contact is not required. Section 2 is where healthcare insurer and telehealth is defined. And telehealth is defined under AS 47. And for those of you who were not in HESS, I can go over the definition of telehealth if the committee would like.
Go ahead.
Okay. So telehealth is defined under AS 47.05.270 subsection E as the practice of healthcare delivery, evaluation, diagnosis, consultation, or treatment using the transfer of healthcare data through audio, visual, or data communications performed over two or more locations between providers who are physically separated from the recipient or from each other, or between a provider and a recipient who are physically separated from each other. So that's section 2. And then Section 3 is where the state or the Alaska Healthcare Insurance Plans will be affected by the Alaska, sorry, Section 3 states that the healthcare insurance plans affected by Section 1 will not be effective before July 1st, 2019. And then the last section, Section 4, the effective date is July 1st, 2019. And the healthcare insurers that are mandated in this bill under Title 21 are the biggest ones are MOTA, United Health, Primera, and Aetna. And I've spoken briefly to all of them, and they have no opposition towards this bill. And that's the sectional.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for the bill sponsor or staff? Seeing none, thank you. We do have invited testimony. We have Vicki Knapp with Mat-Su Health Services. Ms. Knapp, if you can place your name and affiliation on the record and provide us with your testimony, please.
Yes, thank you. My name is Vicki Knapp. I am the COO at Mat-Su Health Services in West Villa. We are a federally qualified health center as well as a behavioral health center, and we are kind of a safety net provider for a lot of the services we provide. We do most of our psychiatry services via telehealth. There's a huge shortage of psychiatric providers currently in the state of Alaska, and they're very difficult to recruit. And the need for psychiatric providers, both psychiatrists and mid-levels, psychiatric nurse practitioners, is the demand is higher than the availability. So a few years ago, we went to telehealth in order to be able to meet that critical need. At this point, we, of course, accept Medicaid, Medicare. We have a sliding fee scale, and we also accept private insurance. We do have some insurance companies who will not pay for telemedicine psychiatry services. And so then the person who's in need of those services, it has limited options. They can pay for it out of pocket, and maybe they qualify for a 50% slide, but it's still fairly expensive. Or they can go without a psychiatric evaluation and potentially some medications to help them with whatever they're experiencing. And that is often the route that these people choose. And so they end up back out of our facility on the streets looking for a provider who will take their private insurance, usually unable to find them. And in the end, they may end up hospitalized or in an emergency room in order to get psychiatric medications because their provider will not pay for psychiatry provided via telehealth.
Thank you, Ms. Knapp. Do we have any questions? Thank you for your testimony. Next up in invited testimony, we have Dr. Linda Freeman. Dr. Freeman, can you place your name and affiliation on the record and provide us with your testimony, please?
Yes, for the record, my name is Dr. Lynn Freeman. I am in Anchorage. I am a private provider for Mind Matters Research, which is my private practice. I also am Director of Integrative Medicine for Alaska Regional Hospital. Today I am, though, just talking specifically from the private provider perspective and for my business. I just wanted to be on the record in full support of this bill. My practice specializes in working with patients who are referred to me by physicians because they have some fairly serious medical issues. And then their emotional well-being, their behaviors, their perceptions are contributing either to a worsening of that physical condition or preventing them from getting best outcomes. I see some patients who may be as far away as Barrow, Alaska, who obviously could not make it in, and yet I can be working with them on what their doctors have ordered if they cannot find their own way through to be able to apply what they're being asked to do for a variety of reasons. Most of my patients, about 85%, are chronic pain. I have many pain physicians who are referring patients to me because they're helping them to come off of opioids and other treatments, and they know that there are many behavioral and perspective approaches we can be using to help them be more comfortable as they're lowering those doses. As a matter of fact, we're actually creating a new program with one of our pain specialists to be able to prepare people for surgery by reducing their opioids and teaching them other methods to manage their pain, not to completely take care of it, but to take that edge off so they can be more better prepared for surgical outcomes and be able to respond to pain medicines after surgery. Also, I really support the idea that patients are already financially strapped if they can save money from not having to drive to and from appointments. When they have chronic pain, it makes their pain worse to have to drive to and from appointments. I just think this bill is really, it makes a lot of sense financially, and from the ethical viewpoint, it also makes a tremendous amount of sense in that regard. So I just wanted to be on the record supporting this, and that's all I have to share at the moment.
Thank you, Dr. Freeman. Do we have any questions for Dr. Freeman? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
This time I will open up public testimony at 4:20 p.m. I do not see anyone signed up for public testimony on House Bill 358. So at this time, we will set House Bill 358 aside until a future meeting and move on to House Bill 376, Create the Alaska State Bank. If we can have, I don't see Representative Tuck, but we can have Charles Duncan come forward.
Wow, the whole crowd went on players.
Mr. Duncan, if you can place your name and affiliation on the record and provide us with your testimony, please. Okay. Mr. Duncan.
The chair. My name is Charles Duncan. I am a researcher with Representative Chris Tuck. The most important reason to establish the Alaska State Bank is to create the legal ability to access federal monetary policy using fractional reserve banking through the United States Treasury and Federal Reserve. Beginning in the year 2008, the Federal Reserve and the United States Treasury began a policy that became known as the bailout of Wall Street. This policy included a total of 50 federal and Federal Reserve programs that ended up providing more than $17 trillion to bail out both the United States and the European financial systems. Today, $4.5 trillion remain on the books of the Federal Reserve from this process. While the President's Working Group on Financial Markets continues to intervene and provide massive subsidies to financial institutions. What is most important to understand from a state government point of view is that the greatest volume of money from this process went to provide capital and reserve requirements for fractional reserve banking. Only fractional reserve banks can access the federal subsidizing of capital and reserve requirements. If you are not doing fractional reserve banking, capital and reserve requirements cannot be used. Currently, 21 state governments are discussing the process of creating fractional reserve banks, and Alaska must recognize the importance of creating the Alaska State Bank. The basic proposal is to create two boards, two committees, and an independent auditor and a computer program. I want to repeat that. The basic proposal is to create two boards, two committees, an independent auditor, and a computer program. The rest of the process will involve using existing institutions. The state, municipalities, boroughs, and port authorities will create the bonds. Private banks and credit unions will originate and service many of the loans. And the University of Alaska will help coordinate the recreation of the Alaska Science and Technology Foundation within the Alaska State Bank. The Alaska State Bank will begin as an infrastructure bank that leverages loans with our local banks and credit unions, and eventually evolve into a full-featured development bank that promotes science, technology, and education. The United States Treasury and the Federal Reserve are looking for solutions that will comply with their mandates. Most importantly, because of the potential for a more dramatic repeat of the 2008 financial crisis. Alaska must be ready to participate in new solutions through creating the legal authority to access federal monetary policy. Let us do what is necessary to participate in federal monetary policy and create the Alaska State Bank. Let us work together to begin a science, education, and infrastructure economic recovery. Thank you for your consideration.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Duncan. I'd also like to acknowledge that we've been joined by Representative Tuck. He joined us at about 4:22 p.m. Representative Tuck, do you have anything else you'd like to add to Mr. Duncan's presentation?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee members. I'm Representative Chris Tuck, serving District 23. I want to thank everybody here for hearing House Bill 376, the Alaska State Bank bill. Representative Kawasaki and I have been working on Alaska State Bank as a method of accessing those federal dollars for investments in Alaska's infrastructure, science, and education. Our basic proposal is to create the legal ability to access federal funding through the monetary policy of the United States Treasury and the Federal Reserve. We are hopeful that we can participate in a monetary policy that controls the money supply and interest rates rather than just relying on a fiscal policy that uses taxes and bonding for those investments. Right now, we are living in a time when every category of infrastructure is in decline in our nation, while trillions of dollars have been bailing out Wall Street since the 2008 crisis. Our nation's bridges, dams, highways, water management systems, and power production and distribution systems are all either beyond their design life or beyond their population capacity. Our federal monetary policy must do more than just bail out the gambling debts of international banks. It must be doing investments at the state level. So now is the time for state governments to demand that direct access to the United States Treasury and Federal Reserve for investments in those infrastructure, science, and education projects. We're not asking for the state of Alaska appropriations, and we are not asking for access to the Alaska Permanent Fund. Our proposal solution for Alaska is to participate with 20 other state governments who are attempting to create state banks and use fractional reserve banking methods to fund infrastructure, science, and education. Working together, we can create state banks that are both united in purpose and designed individually for the special needs and requirements of each state. In designing a state bank of Alaska, we have looked into the history for examples and have success stories most appropriate for Alaska. Our Alaska State Bank proposal is based on two time-proven models, the Bank of Japan and the Reconstruction Finance Corporation in the post-World War II period. And in the packet, you will find some information on that Reconstruction Finance Corporation. We chose the Bank of Japan because of its importance to industrial science and we chose the Reconstruction Finance Corporation because of its emphasis on creating a positive relationship with our federal government. Together, these models can help establish the United States as an Arctic nation powerhouse. At one time, our state had the very successful Alaska Science and Technology Foundation. This foundation provided loans and grants for science, applied technology, and education, but eventually failed to inspire Alaska's political leadership. The money in the foundation ended up being directed towards other priorities, and many great ideas were left to fade into a distant dream. Today, we are stuck with the same old industries that are continuing in decline. Our Alaska State Bank proposal revives the Alaska Science and Technology Foundation and returns it to its original purpose as identified by the name the founders gave to themselves at the University of Alaska, the Committee for Measurable Objectives. The legislation creating the Alaska State Bank contains time-proven performance measures that are consistent with the goals of the original founding members of the Alaska Science and Technology Foundation who were attempting to create a future guided by principles of science. Combining the principles of science with the legal ability to access federal monetary funds will be the key for participating in a successful infrastructure, science, and education-led economic recovery. So let us work hard toward a future that includes Alaska State Bank and lays the foundation for a long-term positive relationship with our federal government. Wall Street and Main Street can share the common interest in returning our state and nation to having a positive future where infrastructure is new, high-paying jobs are plentiful, education is affordable, and science lays the foundation for a brighter future.
All right. Thank you, Representative Tuck. And we've got a question from Representative Stutz and then Representative Birch.
Thank you. Through the chair, excuse me. So I see that it says to facilitate access through the Federal Reserve System. And being it's through the federal banking system, how do you think, or is there any ability for an Alaska State Bank to handle any of the marijuana dollars?
Yes, thank you for the question. We're looking at ways that we can deal with the marijuana industry. This is not the focus of this bank. This is the focus on this bank is a developmental bank. But there's three areas that we are looking at and potentially helping out the marijuana industry. The first one is helping them with the Bank Secrecy Act. And so those are quarterly reports that go to the Federal Reserve, and then we can basically be doing those reporting measures for the banking institutions here in the state of Alaska so that we're the ones that are responsible for those reports. So assisting them in that, it would be like the insulating institution between them and the federal government. And then also having a computer application that actually allows, because right now it's all cash, so having point of sale cards available. So, for example, someone would go in and purchase through the chair. I really apologize about not addressing through the chair originally. But being able to get a point of sale card, for example, you go into a bank and ask for a gift card. That gift card will then be the transaction that somebody can use in a marijuana shop. That way their identity doesn't have to be identified because we don't know what the federal government's going to be doing. And then they can make a purchase right there with that gift card. And that gift card, the reason why we need this computer system is that way at the point of sale, the taxes can be taken right away. The money can be taken right away. And then the bank will issue the profits to the store owner. So a way of creating those deposits as well, a deposit system. And then the third way is just basically accepting any deposits in cash outside of the point of sale card. So those are just three ways that we came up with in trying to assist and help. There may be some other ways, but we just want to get the dialogue started.
Thank you, Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This seems like a terrible idea. I'm spending all my time, through the chair, trying to figure out how to kind of, restrain the growth of state government, and here we are establishing a state bank. Provide financing for economic development projects, hiring state employees, executive director, employees of the bank are state employees in the exempt service, solicit, receive, and accept money. It's not subject to procurement requirements. I guess I'm just trying to understand the genesis for this 20, four-page proposal, because it, you know, at a time when we, at least in my view, think we should be, you know, kind of, you know, what business should we get out of? It seems to be to push the state of Alaska into the business of banking. I don't get it. Through the chair, could you have a maybe a little more explanation on why is this all of a sudden a good idea?
Yes, through the chair. Representative Birch, thank you for the question. If we just rely on a tax and spend type of fiscal policy, you know, that has some restrictions on the economy, whereas what we're trying to do is allow money to be created through the U.S. Treasury and through the Federal Reserve right here in Alaska. And then it also gives us an opportunity, just like we saw in the 2008 crisis, for the Federal Reserve to go ahead and forgive debt. And if we would have already had a state bank at that time, instead of them forgiving gambling debt that happened in the derivatives markets and in Europe and here in the United States, I mean, we would be able to have a lot of our debt from infrastructure projects and science projects here in Alaska forgiven. And so it all, what we're trying to do is direct those federal dollars up here in the state of Alaska so that we can have those investments in necessary economic development projects that we just simply can't do with Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. We can't do with ADA, because they don't have the ability to do fractional reserve banking. So that's what we're hoping to do. If we, I didn't get a chance to go through the sectional, but just a couple things I want to point out. No more, I mean, you can't fund any more than 35% of a project with the state bank, which means that we're going to be partnering with local private banks and others so they can get these projects off the ground. But basically, what we're trying to do is control our own destiny here in the state of Alaska.
Follow up.
Well, you bring up a good point through the chair. Fractional reserve banking, and again, I'm not, you know, I don't pretend to understand this, but it says it means a process by which a bank holds reserves that are a fraction of the amount of the deposit liability. Well, it seems like if you have a large liability, if you only have reserves that are worth a fraction of what that liability is, that seems like, I mean, that's part of the problem we had in the past, is when we weren't, you know, fully covered on those liabilities, through the chair.
And thank you, and through the chair, Representative Birch. It's one of the ways that money is being created is by the Federal Reserve actually buying up some of your debt, and then actually, believe it or not, being able to use that debt to be able to leverage for more debt. It's kind of a weird way, but that's how money is created. Money is created through bank transactions. It's not just through the printing of currency. The printing of currency is only about 3% of our money supply. The rest of it's bank transactions. And so it's the regulations that the U.S. Treasury does over the Federal Reserve in calculating how much debt is going to be out there that new money is created. What we're trying to do is take advantage that when new money is created, it's created here in Alaska to expand the monetary supply up here. And if I may, I want to, Charles, I don't know if you have anything you want to add on that.
Through the Mr. Chair. Duncan, and since we have two male testifiers, if you can just let the record know who's speaking.
Okay. My name is Charles Duncan. Basically, what we're doing is we're asking for money from the Federal Reserve. And the method, there's three basic methods of accessing federal monetary policy. And we saw through this bailout process that, you know, the first method, basically it's loan guarantees. They're guaranteeing loans. And so when I talked about that $17 trillion that was put out to bail out the financial system, most of that 17 went toward loan guarantees. But there's also the capital purchase method, where the Fed just buys bonds, and you don't have to pay them back. And that's what we really prefer. That's what we want. But the General Accounting Office and the Federal Reserve do not prefer that method. They like the credit stimulus method. And basically what that is where you collect up the bonds. You have municipal, port authority bonds, state bonds. You collect them up. You combine those bonds with some stock from your bank. You put that package on account with the Fed, and they consider that package to be your capital and reserve requirements for loaning out new money. And the vast bulk of that money we want to go towards infrastructure.
And if I may add, Mr. Chair,
Representative Tuck,
They call that the credit stimulus method of producing new money, but it's kind of a misuse of terms. It's really a debt stimulus method. So it's based on the debt that you acquire and being able to package those debts into these bond packages that can later be basically leveraged for other bond packages. That's how the federal government creates new money.
So I've got a few questions, actually, and then you can...
Pardon me?
I've got a few questions, and then we can get back to you.
Okay.
And so, Representative Tuck, Mr. Duncan, first question is, are there any other entities, any financial entities that have access to this type of a institution or type of financing or type of capital?
Yes, go ahead. State your name. Charles Duncan. Yes, there's Bank of North Dakota has been... They have
actually,
had a state
I think
bank
you
for many
misunderstood.
Years.
I guess are there entities other than a state chartered bank that are eligible to
yes
receive? Okay, go ahead.
Okay, but remember how I said there's three basic methods of accessing federal monetary policy. If you have an infrastructure bank only, it's not truly a bank if it's just creating bonds, but. Like the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority, they have the ability to create bonds. So of the three basic methods of accessing federal monetary policy, they can access two of those methods. If there was a financial crisis and there's another bailout and they have bonds available, yes, they can get loan guarantees for those bonds, and they can... directly sell those bonds for cash to the Federal Reserve. That's true. But they cannot do fractional reserve banking. They can't put money on account with the Fed and then loan out more money because of that account. And that's what we're trying to create.
And I think that answers my question, basically just wanting to know whether or not there were other entities that can do the fractional reserve, and it sounds like this opens up access to new capital that we don't have access to currently, correct?
That's right.
Representative Birch, question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and through the chair. I guess I am not particularly comfortable in using debt to acquire more debt, and it strikes me that that's, that compounding debt problem is, we got burned with that in 2008 with basically the international financial meltdown. I'm not comforted by bonds that you don't have to pay back. I mean, that seems to me a little disingenuous to say, well, I'm going to borrow money for, because it's a bond, I don't have to pay back.
Representative Birch, do you have a question or you have a
I'm still going back to the genesis for this, this proposal because it as far as making new money, suggestion.
Representative Birch, I guess we will have opportunities to comment about how we feel about the bill when we get to, get to wrap up. Mm-hmm. What we're trying to do now is ask questions of the bill sponsor.
Okay. Maybe you could restate your how it produces new money for me. Thank you.
And if I may, through the chair, just Representative Chris Tuck. Money is, I'm not going to say that money is created out of thin air, but in many ways money is created on this on the credit stimulus method
and new loans.
I mean, it's all through debt. And so what we want to do is make sure that that money is created here in Alaska rather than something that may be a little bit unproductive, such as casinos in Las Vegas or derivatives market or any other non-productive debt allocation or debt acquiring debt. And so right now we have a lot of banks that have a lot of surplus, but they don't have the ability to get that money out on the market as well. And so we were trying to look at the Alaska State Bank as being a method of being able to have a science driver, an infrastructure driver, to be able to utilize that money and get that money out. Because simply right now, a lot of small businesses, even some large businesses, because the interest rates are low, what they're trying to do is pay off the debts that they have. So they're not acquiring any additional debt. This is the way that we can have a vision for Alaska for economic development through infrastructure development, through increasing our productive capacity, through starting up new manufacturing, and to be able to use our university to be able to promote the science and technologies, much the same way that Texas did in developing their petrochemical industry. They invested heavily in their university system, and that's why there's a university component in here. So once the students learned the science and technologies, they were able to apply the materials development, the process methods, and the machine tool technology right there for their home state.
And Mr. Duncan? I would answer the question a little more directly. I think the central issue in monetary policy is what you increase the money supply for. We've had a period of deregulation, and essentially we are increasing our money supply for futures, options, indexes, swaps, the hedge fund market, debt pyramiding, asset stripping, debt for equity. Predatory finance has had a massive subsidy since the deregulation began 25 years ago. And what we're proposing is to, instead of subsidizing the gambling, we subsidize agriculture, industry, infrastructure, science, technology, those things that make us more productive in the future. That's a central issue. Are you going to increase your money supply for speculation or production?
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Stutz and then Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you. Through the chair, I don't think I've quite grasped this concept here. So can you tell me really simply, like you're talking to a third grader maybe, how you're going to – I understand somehow you're going to get some federal dollars is what it sounds to me. But I've lost the connection as to how exactly you're going to get federal dollars. Is it by accruing debt? You say, people, come into my bank and I'm going to give you some money? Because if that's the case, I'm in.
Mr. Duncan?
Through the chair, I would most directly answer that question by saying that we have a debt-based monetary system. Maybe we should have a credit-based monetary system, but the basic method that we're advocating is for state, municipal, port authorities, development finance authorities, create bonds. Those bonds are then put on account with the Alaska State Bank. The state bank then issues stock. You create a securitized package. That package is then put on account with the Federal Reserve. And because you have that account, it is considered your capital and reserve requirements for loading new money.
And so, if I may, Mr. Chair, that is where people get caught up, because it doesn't make sense. You're actually putting debt on account for more debt. And that's how the Federal Reserve regulates that in creating new money, and that's how new money is actually created.
And I guess for Representative Stutz, one of the things I might say, so basically, correct me if I don't have this correct, my understanding is that basically what we're doing is creating, in a sense, a revolving loan fund. So we have issued bonds for a project, which means we're paying for that project. Those bonds are to be paid back. If we put those on account with the Federal Reserve that knows that those bonds will be paid back. So in order to keep that revolving loan fund supported, it actually says, okay, you've got those bonds, those are going to be paid back. We'll give you a certain amount of credit because we know you're going to be getting paid back on these bonds. And that money you can use to lend out for other stuff. And
that's so right. That's exactly it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Stutz, does that help?
It helps somewhat, but what I'm hearing is we never are debt-free again. I mean, we'll always owe somebody money. Is that
Representative
pretty
Stutz,
much right?
And I guess we're kind of getting into a little bit of a discussion, but I think we are, with this bank, we would be in a situation where somebody owes us money because we've sold bonds, people have bought those bonds, that money is due to the state or the state bank. And what the feds are saying is, well, we're going to multiply that debt in a way that we know you're going to be getting a certain amount of payments back every year, and we're going to offer you some money based on those payments that will be coming back into the system. And so it kind of is a bootstrapping of a revolving loan fund.
Follow up, if I might, just one quick question. So what I'm hearing is essentially then we would take the bonds that we've sold and sell them to the feds. Is that about right?
Through the chair, that's not quite the right word. You put them on account with the Fed because you still have those bonds. They still are within the state bank. You're not giving that money to them. You're not selling it to them. It's still on your account.
If I add,
I'm getting closer. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Tuck.
Representative Stutes, that is also another way it can be done, and ADA can do that now. It just doesn't happen. The Federal Reserve doesn't prefer that method. They prefer the method to where you can put those on account, and then and that's what ADA can't do, and that's why we were asking for the state bank.
And I think, so I guess maybe, and Representative Sullivan Leonard has a question, but I'm kind of getting interested in this subject.
Thank you. I've got a little bit better grasp on it.
But I guess I'm thinking that would it be safe to say that what we are doing is utilizing our bonds as our debt security that are basically our collateral?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for the record, Representative Tuck, that's correct.
Okay, thanks. Representative Sullivan Leonard. Okay.
Thanks, through the chair. I guess I'm looking for a fiscal note on what it would cost to get the state bank established and up and running.
Question.
Through the chair.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if we have the fiscal notes here.
No, that won't come until the next step in the process. But keep in mind, through the chair.
Mr. Duncan.
Keep in mind that we're only creating four groups of people, so we're not, the total cost will not be that great because we have two committees and two boards, basically four groups of people. You have an executive board, you have a review board, and then you have a committee for the money coming in and a committee for the money going out. So you're not talking about that large a bureaucracy.
Okay, thank you. Follow up?
Okay. Nope, thanks.
Any other questions for Bill Sponsor? Seeing none, we do have Ms. Christine Naylor available for questions from the Division of Banking and Securities. Do we have any questions for Ms. Naylor? Seeing no questions, I will open up public testimony at 4:50 p.m. And I do not have anybody signed up for public testimony. Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify? Seeing no one, we will leave public testimony open and set House Bill 376 aside for a future meeting. At this time, having no other business to come before the committee, we will move towards adjournment, but I want to let everybody know on Wednesday, April 11th at 3:15 p.m., we are anticipating a hearing for our second hearing, SB 108 Medical Care Licensing Medical Board, and then a first hearing on House Bill 357, Alcohol Beverage Control and Regulation. And with that, no further business to come before Labor and Commerce. We stand adjourned at 4:51 p.m.